when you eat a baguette that's so crusty on the outside that it hurts the inside of your mouth, do you fault the bread maker? Like, is that poorly made bread?
Well, first of all, you have to decide whether pain's a good thing or a bad thing. So depending on the mood you're in, you might feel you deserve the pain because you're about to get the pleasure.
This is Christopher Kimball, founder of America's Test Kitchen. He's famous for testing recipes over and over and over until they're so foolproof that even the most bumbling home cook can't screw them up. And for most people, it works. But all that testing is hard.
I think pain's great. I mean, I grew up in Vermont. So, I mean, everything's painful. Winter's painful. Mud season's painful. Haying's painful. Milking's painful. It's good. Builds character.
This is,
you're looking at me like
no,
what is wrong with this
guy? No, that's not what I'm more like processing, because I came in to talk to you being like, in some ways I feel like you and I have a very similar approach to food, and other ways almost diametrically opposed. And I'm so interested to hear you talk a little bit more about like the thought process of how you come to like and dislike what you like.
We're different halves of the same person. I say cooking is hard. Anyone who says you can cook for eight people for dinner in 30 minutes is just not true.
Right.
And you say eating's hard. I mean, if you just want to have a sandwich, it's complicated. There's a lot of things to think about. There's too much bread. You have the cucumber and the tomato. The lettuce is the wrong kind of lettuce. The friction quotient's wrong, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're
I
exactly.
Mean, this is hard stuff.
And I think you and I share a belief that even the foods that people have had so many times before can be improved through analysis and rigorous study.
So Chris and I are both food obsessives, but like I said, in other ways, we're really different.
Okay, there are two kinds of people. Someone who gets up, jumps in the shower, gets fully dressed immediately, and then has a cup of coffee. Are you the slippers and pajamas? Yeah, I can
yeah,
tell.
I'm yeah. coffee before
yeah,
shower.
You're slippers and shuffle.
Okay. Chris, I mean, if I get home at 6 o'clock and my pajama pants aren't on it by 6:30, then something's wrong.
you and I were born in different universes. I had dinner at 7 in a coat and tie every night. What can I tell you? You just go like, this guy's like completely whacked.
Our different preferences in evening wear carry over into our feelings about food. I love the edible equivalent of pajama pants. Food that provides comfort and pleasure. Chris, on the other hand, he once told the New York Times, quote, "There's something about pleasure I find annoying." Today on The Sporkful, I'll try to understand how a person who's dedicated his career to food could say such a thing. Plus, we'll argue about pie a la mode and corn on the cob. Stick around. From WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. Christopher Kimball obsesses about food, too, on his show, America's Test Kitchen.
Tender. Now, meat, generally speaking, is about 5.5 to 6 pH. That means it's slightly acidic. By adding baking soda, the meat goes from slightly acidic to being alkaline in the 8 to 9 range. Now, why is that important? Alkaline meat retains moisture better when it's cooked.
People love Chris's approach. The company he founded now brings in more than $50 million a year. When Chris and I met up, we started off obsessing about pie a la mode. He isn't a fan.
Pie is the perfect food. Don't mess it up. It's not like gravy on mashed potatoes. Mashed potatoes, you can need help. Pie, an apple pie, please. Anyway, but you don't like cold ice cream on hot pie.
Yeah, I mean, I one of the things that I focus on a lot is the temperature of foods. And as someone who loves ice cream, I'm especially preoccupied with the temperature of ice cream when I eat it. You don't want your ice cream to be frozen solid because...
totally agree.
Right. As ice cream melts, it will increase in flavor and aroma. So to me, the best ice cream is like half melted. Ideally, you want to be able to eat your ice... You want all the ice cream bites to be at the optimal temperature. If you take a scoop of ice cream and drop it on top of a hot piece of pie, you have about 30 seconds of a window of optimal consumption before you're going to have soup. And that's going to be too melted. So... don't do that. You know, if you want the pie to be a little bit warm and you're going to put the ice cream on frozen solid, yeah, that's okay. But the extreme contrast is going to melt your ice cream too quickly.
But you should never, here we go.
Yeah.
You should never serve warm pie. P- pie is much better cold, especially apple pie. It has, for some reason, it has more flavor. It has more tartness to it.
Yeah, I feel like when the pie is cold, the crust is better. The crust has a density.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. And also, it has to settle like a stew. I mean, pie takes time to mature, like a fine wine.
Right. You need a good vintage. Can I say one more thing about ice cream and pie? Because I've been doing this, I've been on a real pie kick lately, and maybe this will sell you on ice cream and pie, Chris. Think of it as a slightly different dish, pie a la mode. And I want you to take a slice of pie and a scoop of ice cream, and I want you to mash up the pie and mash up the ice cream and mix until the ice cream is half melted and the pie is all, like the thing is just mushed together so they become one.
That is the worst culinary idea I have ever heard. I'm sorry. That's not even in the ballpark.
It's so good.
A slice of pie is beauty. It's art. It's perfection. You want to... No, please. I mean, come on. I'm with you on the hot dog
thing. I'm tempted to get you in a cab right now and go get us some pie and some ice cream.
That's fine. You eat the ice cream, I'll eat the pie. Now, the one thing you and I violently disagree about is corn on the cob.
Oh.
It's called corn on the cob for a reason, because you eat it on the cob. So, okay, so here you are on the farm, and you have a dozen ears, and you throw it in the water for 3 minutes. You pull it out, and you stack it on a big plate. You put it. Now, you'd like to eat it off the cob. So what do? You stand it up, and you cut it off?
Right.
That's even more annoying than pizza with a fork and knife, man. That's really something. But, really? I mean, do you really do that?
Absolutely.
And then you eat the kernels with a spoon?
Yes, of course.
Man, you're...
What, are you going to use a fork? They'll fall through the tines.
You're right. You're on the outer edge of whacked eating.
I do that, and I think there's a few reasons why it's better. First, you get more corn because the knife will really cut those kernels off down to the bone. You don't get those like clear pods that stay stuck to the cob. And whenever I eat corn on the cob, I always get half the corn stuck in my teeth, so I find it very uncomfortable and unpleasant. Also, seasoning corn on the cob is very messy, and it's difficult to season it evenly.
Okay. You take a stick of butter.
Okay.
You roll. Everyone uses the same stick, which you pass around. It's communal.
Right.
It's a way of getting closer to your neighbors. You roll it on the butter, and then you put the kosher salt on it, and yeah. But I mean, and then
don't you end it with butter all over your hands and face? Like, once you pick it up and actually eat it?
I would say that's the point, but I don't know.
Clearly, Chris is a guy with strong opinions. And not just about food. He also has a lot to say about food media. All those cookbooks and blogs and food TV shows that we all watch.
They're all salespeople. They're selling you on a recipe. They're selling you on a technique. They're selling you on a lifestyle. And most of the time, the disparity between what they're selling you and the reality of your home kitchen is so vast that it's fiction. I mean, it's really fiction. And so I think it's better to say to people, as I always have, cooking, like everything else worth doing, is hard. It takes time.
And Chris hates it when people make it sound fun and easy. Another thing that really bothers him?
Oh, I hate the word celebration.
Okay.
I mean, go back to the olden times. You know, the trappers would be out west. Once a year in the spring, they'd all come, or summer, they'd come down for this two-week-long party. But these guys were out there for 50 weeks out of the year, like shooting bear and trapping muskrat and everything else, beaver. And they had a really hard life. And so they came down and once a year had a party. Now, that they earned that party. But the idea of celebrating something without the context of the hard work part, it just drives me crazy. Maybe that paints me slightly as a Yankee.
You're very puritanical.
I am. I mean, I'm not a party, as you can gather. I mean, I like small groups of people. I like that. But a big party, I feel like I'm supposed to be having fun. I mean, that's why the summer.
That sounds awful.
Well, it is. It's like in the summer, everyone has a good time, and their bathing suits are on the beach, and they're eating this and having a great time. I'm like miserable. It's like, give me winter. I like winter. I like cold, 40 degrees raining, out there hunting. That's it. I mean.
You like the pain.
I like the context of hardship. Is actually a comforting notion in some way. Am I paying you for this? This couch is really uncomfortable. That's all I can say.
I have some tissues right here. Geez,
I feel like I might need one any moment.
Coming up, my session with Chris Kimball continues.
He'll tell us a little more about those 7 p.m. dinners in jacket and tie growing up. And he'll tell us why he has no guilty pleasures. Stick around. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC Studios. I'm Dan Pashman. We're working on a show right now, and we'd love to have your help. We want your stories about school lunches, the lunches you ate growing up. Whatever you ate, wherever you ate it, we want to hear about it. We're especially interested in stories about something surprising happening, maybe something traumatic happened, something that stays with you to this day, maybe something hilarious that took place. Perhaps you discovered a new food by trading lunches with somebody else. I feel like there are so many formative experiences that we have in the lunchroom growing up, and I would love to hear about yours. So please record a voice memo on your cell phone where you tell me the story and email it to me at dan@sporkful.com. Thanks. As I said, Christopher Kimball is the founder of America's Test Kitchen and host of America's Test Kitchen Radio, which, by the way, is also a podcast, so get it today wherever you got this podcast. So Chris mentioned earlier that he grew up having dinner every night in a jacket and tie. Now, I don't know about you, but that's not how I grew up having dinner. So what was the deal with that?
Well, I had two worlds. I had the world of the school year, where we had a very formal household. And yeah, jacket and tie. My grandmother on my mother's side lived in Washington on Calorama Road, which was the ultimate formal. I mean, she was about 4 feet tall, blue rinse hair, a complete terror, you know, terrorized my mother. And we would have radishes and celery exactly at 7. We had a, you know, the water bowl, you know, with a doily, the whole thing. That was her world. And then the other world I had was, you know, haying and milking cows in a fly-infested barn in Vermont. And my mother was an organic farmer back in the 60s, as a hobby. She was a teacher at Columbia, actually. So we had all these great organic vegetables, but no salt, no seasonings. So I didn't grow up with good food from her. In Vermont, in the summers, weekends, when I worked on a farm, I did eat at the farmhouse where I worked, and the food was terrific. You know, it was Anadama bread, which has molasses and cornmeal in it, all sorts of cookies and pies and roasts and potatoes. And the farmers, they get a huge roast potato with every meal, except breakfast, I guess. And to open it, they had a method. It's the fist method. And you just smash the potato with a fist, and it just opens up nicely, and then the steam comes out. So you have to master that. But that was...
How hard do you hit it?
Well, that's complicated. We don't have enough time. I mean, that's all. That's 2,000 hours right there, man.
Have you done this in Cooks Illustrated?
No, I did suggest
that. The potato fist smash?
I suggest that as an illustrated spread, but it didn't go over too well.
So you put in your 2,000 hours and then some cooking. Like, do you remember when you first got bit by this bug when you got into this?
Oh, yeah. I was 7 or 8 years old. It was Fannie Farmer book, and I made a chocolate cake, layer cake, which turned out the cake was fine. But then I made a 7-minute boiled frosting, which is I still have trouble doing. And the egg whites, you heat them with the sugar and you beat them. And it turned out exactly like the consistency of snot. I mean, it was, and it looked like it in the whole thing. And so I had this gluey, thin, you know, mucilaginous layer on top of this chocolate cake. Served it to my family. They all said, "This is great." And I go, "Hey, this is easy." You know, complete failure. But people were so appreciative. So, yeah, you know, that's how I got started with a chocolate cake.
So what was it about that experience?
I think sometimes when you get started with something, you have a good experience. And for no particular reason, pure luck, or even it's a failure, but you're so happy that you did it. So then you go down the rabbit hole of figuring out how it really works. That first experience, good or bad, is always transformative because you realize there's some potential there. It doesn't have to be a win. And I thought it was easy. And then the more I know, the more difficult it becomes.
Right.
So cooking is infinitely complex. So you never figure it out. It's like music. You never get to the end.
And I mean, you're well known in your work in America's Test Kitchen and Cooks Illustrated for the sort of obsessive pursuit of
obsession.
Obsession, right? I'm reluctant to say perfection because I, you know, what's perfection? But
For the level of rigor that you bring to recipe testing and analysis, has that always been part of your personality?
Yeah, because when I first started taking cooking lessons in the early 70s, first of all, if you were a cooking teacher and you saw me sitting in the first row, you want to bring your 7mm Browning to the next class and like, let me have it. Because I kept asking questions. I realized the teacher didn't actually know any of the answers, really. The thing was make a bechamel. Okay, so you have a roux, butter, and flour, stir it together a couple minutes. And then you would have to heat up the milk in a separate saucepan and add it in and whisk it, right, so it thickens. Well, it turns out you don't have to heat the milk. And so I'd ask the guy, I said, well, why do you heat the milk? And he'd say, well, you have to. Well, I went home and did it with cold milk, worked just fine. Well, the reason is, of course, because before pasteurization, there's an enzyme in the milk that would make it difficult to thicken. So I'm going, okay. And so then I went through a whole series of other things and realized that it was all hand-me-down. You know, it was like, we did it this way because, you know, Escoffier did it in 1903. So it was interesting to me to say, well, let's just test it.
Where do you get that drive for perfection from? Is it like in your family? Do you have relatives who were like that? Like, where do you think that comes from?
Well, it's the old Vermont thing, you know, about being useful. I think a lot of people in modern culture want to do less work or work, you know, get it out of the way so we can have fun. And I always felt, and I still feel, that the doing something you love to do, doing it well and putting a lot of effort into it is the fun, really. I mean, you're sitting here doing what you love, so am I. That's the fun part. I mean, it's more fun than anything else. So I don't view it as rigorousness. I view it as pleasure because all those hours put into something gets you to the point you get good at it. And once you get good at something, then it's really fun, you know? It's hard work up to a point, but then all of a sudden, that painting turns out great, or that song turns out great, or that recipe turns out great, or you're able to teach people how to cook. You know, it doesn't get much better than that. I mean, there are a few things in life which are great, but that's got to be one of them.
Are there other things that you are as OCD about as you are about food and cooking?
Well, in large parts of my life, I'm the opposite of OCD, as my wife will tell you. Music and food are the two areas I'm OCD. Everything else, I'm a complete loser. Total loser.
Like when you come home at the end of the day, and you take your blazer off, do you throw it on the bed or the floor, or do you hang it up on a hanger?
Blazer, no, I have a suit.
Suit, sorry.
Okay. Excuse me. Blazer, what is this? My herringbone blazer? Yeah. With the leather patches on the elbows? I don't think so. It's my dark suit.
And do you hang the suit up?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay.
No, so we're very strict. We have closet rules.
Okay.
Yes, very important.
Because if I'm on the rare occasions I'm wearing a suit, I will take it off, and I always end up just hanging it on the doorknob of my closet.
No.
It's just there for like 4 days. Then finally, I build up the motivation to put it on a hanger.
Your wife and mine are very different people because a coat on a doorknob would not be there for more than 5 minutes, not 5 days. That doesn't work. That just does not go over too well.
Final question for you. What's one of your top food guilty pleasures?
Oh, you're not going to ask me this.
Why?
Everybody, what's a guilty pleasure?
So everyone, that's a common question you get asked a lot?
I get asked, what's your favorite recipe, which you've been asked a million times? And I don't, look.
What do you think it says about the way that people perceive you that they ask that question to you a lot?
It's either a pleasure or it's not. How could you have a guilty pleasure? I don't get it.
What if someone were to give you some really delicious food that you didn't work hard for and you ate it and it was good? Would you feel guilty?
No, I'd say thank you. I just do not understand guilt. Guilt is a way of making yourself feel better about doing something you shouldn't have done. I mean, simply put, if you're going to eat the donuts, enjoy the donuts.
That's Christopher Kimball. He's the founder of America's Test Kitchen and the host of America's Test Kitchen Radio, which, by the way, is also available as a podcast. So get that today wherever you got this podcast. Next week on the show, we'll meet Southern Baptist matzah expert,
And I'll debate kosher law with an Orthodox rabbi. Passover's coming. Get psyched. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheSporkful. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/Sporkful. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. Our engineer is Irene Trudell. We got music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to Paula Schumann. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Janaris Sanchez from Rochester, New York, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.